Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we're back with a little bit more of a traditional episode this week, although maybe we'll integrate some pieces from our previous thoughts and feelings episode. Shall we start with maybe, ladies, to get us back to normal, what are we drinking?
I am drinking, well, first of all, it's coffee I made this morning, Erin. Less because I care about freshness of coffee and more because I'm drinking a lot more coffee these days, so I run out the day before. Yep. So fresh coffee that I stirred a tablespoon of hot chocolate, fancy hot chocolate mix into with some Frangelico. So it's kind of like a cocktail from the morning.
Yeah, it's like a mocha. Oh, that sounds delightful.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely. Radha, how about you?
Yeah, I told Erin when we were setting up that I'm drinking all the alcohols. First, I made myself my normal morning coffee, and I've been practicing making vanilla lattes for myself with like shaking and vanilla powder, right? And then I was like, well, I might as well put a little whiskey in this. It'd be kind of like a fancy Irish coffee, like kind of tendency. So I did that. And then as I was coming downstairs, my husband was like, didn't you open that champagne to have with Bombshell? And I was like, you're right. I sure did. And so I just also poured myself a glass of champagne. So that's where we are this morning. And I didn't mix it with anything because I was just like, why?
Well, you buy good champagne. And as we all know how I feel about mimosas, don't go ruining my good champagne with your crappy orange juice. So I am just drinking LaCroix. I'm trying to sort of readjust my relationship with all the alcohol in my house. So I think we're, you know, it's the passion fruit LaCroix. I got to tell you, it does go great with gin if you want to go that direction. But at the moment,
but on average, we've got a drink per person. So
yes,
don't worry, I got
you. Right. We're all set. So
you're welcome.
Well, this morning, we are, or afternoon or evening, whenever you're listening to this, we are delighted to have, Nora Ben-Sahel with us. Nora, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. It's a delight to be here.
Nora is a visiting professor of strategic studies at the School for Advanced International Studies, or as we call it here, just SAIS. Thank you for joining us, and we have kind of a lot to get into, but I will not forget this time.
Yay!
We're going to start with the bombshell questions. So I'll ask the first one because it's the one that I can remember, which is, what book would you like to live in forever?
The answer to that one is really easy for me. It's Harry Potter all the way. And I started on my first night of quarantine or whatever we're calling this, I decided that I needed to start the series at the beginning and reread book one. And I'm only letting myself read it at night before I go to bed so I can purge all the day's news out of my head.
Excellent idea.
We've been listening to that audiobook while coloring. That is not a normal daytime activity for me, but it is for me and my son. We do a lot of coloring. So we listen to that. And that, because the audiobook, if you haven't listened to it before, it's just delightful. Really, really well done.
My husband is doing out loud reading of The Hobbit to our whole household.
Oh, that's nice.
So it's...
What's the varying levels of entertainment on that front?
Well, he is definitely the most entertained by it.
Yeah.
And are you and the baby rivaling for the basement there?
Well, there's a lot of sounds that come out that none of which sound that happy, but we'll leave attribution aside.
Okay.
Very well. Next question. Lauren, do you want to do it?
If you could develop any skill, what would it be?
I thought you were going to ask me about superpower, because I know you've done that before, and I came up with a superpower. But if you say skill, I would love to be an Olympic athlete for a day.
And wouldn't that be great?
I would just love to live inside that body and know, you know, I don't even really care the sport, to just know what it's like to be that kind of athlete.
I've always thought that, like, for when they show Olympic events, they should just show a regular person doing whatever they're, like, a fit regular, not like a,
like a college
show
athlete.
Show like a regular runner. Yeah. Just like running behind the people running in the track, just to show you like how much like physically better they are.
Yeah. When you see them all competing against each other, right? It's like anybody can do that.
Did you see the Usain Bolt tweet where he said social distancing, where he's got his arm out and he's like 3 feet ahead of the people in the 100-yard dash? It was pretty amazing. I mean, that's like Muhammad Ali level shade. It was fantastic.
Where in the world would you like to visit before climate change destroys it? Guys, I think we're going to need to...
Yeah, this has to be like when the quarantine ends.
Yeah, well, that's probably going to be a wine bar near me when the quarantine ends. But the answer to the climate change question is I would love to go to Antarctica. A friend of mine just came back from there, and you know, it's not something I had really considered before she came back. But she was telling me all about it, and I love penguins. A little afraid of the whole cruise ship thing, so that'll be a while, but someday, someday.
If you could add a robot to your household that could do anything that, like, so our previous examples have been, in my case, to sniff out the weird smell that's coming from somewhere that I don't know what it is in my house and fix it. What was Rada's again?
To walk behind my children, just wiping them and their various, which seems extra useful now, guys.
Totally. That was brilliant. Anyway, what would your robot do?
Mine is such a no-brainer for me. It's a litter box scooper.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah. I love my cats, but I do not love the litter box.
There's like, we added a dog to our household, as I talked about in the last episode, and there's just like a lot of extra things to clean at that point. Like, it's not that bad. It's just more like, why did I add an additional creature that has fluids in its body?
Well, Nora, we've been meaning to have you on to join us for quite some time, but this is a particularly, I guess, timely episode. You had a recent column with Dave Barno in War on the Rocks, where you guys have a regular column, and talking about kind of defense priorities and how we might rethink about not just the overall defense budget, but kind of what makes us safe and how we should prioritize our spending across a whole range of topics. And it caught my attention. I think it caught a lot of people's attention. There's more than a few people talking about, you know, how we're going to get to the overall Defense Department response to the specifics of this pandemic, to haircut or not to haircut. That is the question. but wondered if you could maybe summarize some of the points in your piece, and we'll kind of dive into a discussion about national security and human security and all the things that get tied up in the DoD budget process.
I think the main idea behind that piece, and one that is going to have huge implications for our community going forward, is that I think for most Americans, the definition of what constitutes national security is going to change very profoundly. In our community, we think, and in the Defense Department, we think of national security as being focused on external threats. And those are certainly not going to go away. The Department of Defense is going to still have a key role in protecting the nation against external threats. But given the pandemic, most Americans are going to look at how woefully unprepared the United States was, is going to look at the Department of Defense budget, which is, you know, $700 billion a year, which is half the discretionary budget, and that's 15% of the overall government budget. And the Department of Defense, through no fault of its own, has played very little role in the response to this because it's not designed to do that. So I think the political pressure that comes out of this moment, and, you know, we're still in the very early days, even if we're all released from our homes, you know, in the next few weeks, that we're not going to be done with the pandemic for months. The way most Americans think about their security is going to be about personal security, about their health, their welfare, other types of domestic threats that could lead to other terrible situations that they face. And that's going to be a huge challenge for our community and for the defense budget, but that's a secondary outcome, right? It's the reconceptualization of national security, I think, that our community is really going to have to struggle with.
So we've talked about this in a couple different veins over the years, and I'm wondering if you think that this is a discontinuity, you know, a new trend, or something that's sort of continuing. Because I think about this, and I think about all the years where public opinion surveys had terrorism, and they meant domestic terrorism. Well, terrorism on American soil as number one threats. And then, you know, the national security community had kind of moved on from that. You know, that was a 2002, 2003 problem, not a 2012 problem. Similarly, you have kind of immigration concerns or folks who see threats, you know, again, materializing. And so in some ways, it's part of this discussion around the Department of Homeland Security more broadly. But I'm wondering if you think that this is going to be a really, really sharp change or kind of a culmination of some trends that have been going on in terms of the way the American public, that maybe the distance between the American public sense of security and the national security community's threat assessments more broadly.
So I actually think it's both. There clearly were elements of this before. And, you know, I think a lot of Americans have, as you pointed out, thought about threats to the homeland for a long time. in ways that, again, that's not the Department of Defense job to think about most of the time. But this is also going to be a huge discontinuity in everything facing the United States. We are not going to go back to the way of life we had before. We are going to be changed in our political priorities, in our personal lives, in our economics, in ways that, you know, we can't even begin to predict now. I think the only certainty is that things will be very different. And we'll see what those, you know, second, third, fourth order effects are of this pandemic when it's over. So I do think, even though there had been a lot of sentiment there already, and a lot of Americans had already, if you asked them what the greatest, they felt the greatest threats to the United States were, would have said more domestic things, we're going to reshape almost every aspect of our lives to try to prevent a pandemic from happening again. And I don't know, again, exactly where that will go in terms of the specifics, but that trend to me is inescapable, that's what people are going to be thinking about.
And let me ask Aaron's question on a slightly different frame, which is, you know, we've been seeing playing out this debate between sort of internationalism versus more like nationalist or protectionist or autarkic, or depending on the word you want to use, tendencies. And my question here is, do you feel like as we start reframing this, that this creates more of a case or justification for internationalist sort of institutions? And, you know, we used to talk a lot about NATO, more and more we're talking about things like the WHO. Or do you think this creates the case for much, like, for a lot of these controls, including protectionist and supply chain controls, being a national security imperative, right? In a world where we've reframed this national security issue.
So I hate to say it again, but I think the answer is yes to both of those too. I think I promise I'll have a different answer to your next question. But I think that it is going to cause, in not just in national security, but primarily in economics, a retreat from globalization as we've known it, in terms of just-in-time logistics and vast extended international supply chains. Some of those things will still happen, but I think there's going to be, around the world, not just in the United States, a much greater focus on domestic resiliency for crises. So having stockpiles of materials, of being able to have critical assets manufactured at home so that you can guarantee supply. I'm not an economist, so
Radha sure is. That's why we have her here.
So I'll leave it to you, Radha, to unpack all of that. But I do think that is going to definitely increase a focus inward and domestically, and towards whether or not it's explicit protectionism or just a focus on domestic rebuilding. I think that will be there. To whether it fosters more internationalism at the same time, though, I think that will depend on the outcome of the next election. I think if Trump is reelected, you're going to see exactly what we've had in really the past 3.5 years, but especially what's happened vis-a-vis the pandemic and the WHO is, you know, a pulling back, a blaming international organizations. I think that trend line will just exacerbate if Trump is reelected. If a Democrat is elected, presumably Joe Biden, I think that there will be a return to a sense of international cooperation, at least as far as pandemics and readiness are concerned. I can see a move back towards the WHO and funding it and trying to get some amount of international cooperation there. I think that's a bedrock assumption. Internationalism is as a positive force in a lot of democratic politicians and democratic minds. But again, the aftermath of this pandemic, there's going to be a limit to how that's going to play out. Does that affect our position on NATO? Probably not. I think independent of the pandemic, we'll try to, under a Democrat, we would try to re-engage with NATO and try to reestablish an international role. But again, in the mind of most Americans and in terms of domestic priorities, those issues are going to recede in importance to the average American, even though they're still going to remain critically important and our community will still have to work on them.
So Nora, to bring together a couple of different threads that you've talked about, in post 9/11, was the last really big domestic institution building period that the United States went through, in that it's in order to address the terrorism threat, it put together the Department of Homeland Security and then did a lots of intelligence community reform, and they developed a lot of smaller institutions specifically aimed at the threat of domestic terrorism, with international threats from whence it emanated. And there was a lot of problems with that, but two trends in that were really interesting to me. One, that we absolutely overleaned into the terrorism threat without necessarily keeping our eyes on the horizon for what other threats may come up. But then another one being in the case of at least the Department of Homeland Security, we developed a new institution towards that threat, but gave it almost no authorities to actually deal with domestic terrorism threats, and also didn't give it a lot of the kind of oversight and governance functions that would have helped it be more effective. It's still, at heart, an organization built around immigration and customs that, and without the cyber or terrorism or other kinds of authorities it would necessarily need. So if you could give a couple of pieces of advice to a new administration or the current administration as they're thinking through, wow, we probably need to like build something new here in order to address this, what kind of pieces of advice would you give to them as they're thinking through, do we need new organizations or bodies or authorities in order to address this these threats as they come forward?
I'm sure we will need some new authorities, especially in the federal government in terms of preparedness, stockpiling, resilience, all those sorts of things. I don't think that there's going to be a massive U.S. government reorganization to address this, though. The 9/11 attacks revealed a very serious institutional gap that we had, that nobody was looking after the homeland. Here, the problem with the pandemic isn't that we didn't know pandemics could be a problem. It's that we didn't fund the offices. The administration closed some of those offices. The Department of Health and Human Services does not have pandemics as one of its big missions. That could happen in the future, again, depending on what the extent of the fallout from this ends up being. But I don't see a major new institutional reorganization as much as I do see a shift in resources. And that's where the implication for the Department of Defense comes in, right? You know, it's like the old joke, why do you rob a bank? Because that's where the money is. You know, any of these new initiatives, not to mention just even dealing with the economic fallout of the crisis, and you know, we can talk more about this, but the extraordinary levels of debt we're going into, we're just at the beginning of that because our economic responses so far have proven insufficient. The money's going to come from DOD because there isn't much else, there aren't that many other places to go. I think you could see a movement politically for all sorts of things that have been off the table until now. I think that there's going to be a movement to increase taxes in the aftermath of this. And again, by aftermath, I'm talking like 1 to 2 years once we get back to whatever the new normal is, to pay for all of these new initiatives. I think we could see some moves towards entitlement reform because that is the biggest part of the U.S. government budget. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I think DOD is going to be the bill payer for this shift of resources into pandemic and domestic threat planning, simply because it's got a ton of money.
So just to come back to that a little bit more specifically, Nora, your piece talks about a few places or speculates, I mean, really across all the accounts where you think that some of these hits could be made. You know, we have sort of been here before in a little bit sense, right? And there were definitely hits to the defense budget in some ways after the financial crisis in 2008, 2009. Really, that came a few years later with calls for, you know, when we had sequestration and then the Budget Control Act. I agree. I mean, I'd be kind of interested in the politics of this. Obviously, there's questions around procurement and kind of, you know, will there be, you know, modernization versus, you know, other kinds of trade-offs. But one of the things I wanted to kind of push you on a little bit was there's a discussion, you know, certainly around kind of the economic impact of COVID-19. And I think the question around tax receipts is a really important one, especially at the state and local levels. But there's also this question around jobs. And so I wonder if we could talk, you know, a little bit about end strength, and would we really be cutting end strength in a period of, you know, substantial job loss in other places? Or is this an opportunity to, you know, treat DOD in a more domestic, you know, kind of jobs type program and focus more on those aspects of things than, for example, precise investments in the strategic competition with China?
I think end strength is almost certainly going to have to go down. And part of the reason for that is if you have to take budget cuts, as we know from sequestration, right? If you have to take budget cuts in a specific fiscal year, the easiest way to do that is to cut from personnel accounts. It's much harder to get into multi-year procurement to get current year money savings. But even beyond that, I think that the philosophy is going to be that if you have to cut across the Defense Department budget, you have to take end strength cuts in order to preserve any hopes for modernization. In order to, and I think that, you know, even though I would prefer that we do a clean look at our procurement and modernization. I think the jobs issue and the fact that most of our major platforms, the F-35, big ships and everything have components supplied across the 50 states. I think the jobs logic is going to argue against cutting procurement for legacy platforms, which I actually think is the wrong thing. That should be one of the things that should be changed. And those investments should be made in next generation systems. I think the jobs pressure is going to come from Congress there to keep those platforms and procurement alive as long as possible. But I think that end strength is going to have to go down. There's especially, I think, in the land services. I think the Army is going to get hit. I think the Marines are going to get hit because,
you just called the Marines a land service. Now we're going to get all kinds of hate mail.
It has had a primarily land role in.
Oh, I know. I know.
I've just set myself up for, and I would be remiss if I didn't remark on General Berger's not only strategic guidance, but recent decisions on what to divest from. But, you know, the Marine Corps is going to have to get smaller, even as a sea service, because ultimately its job is about projecting people onto land. It does so from the sea. I think that those end strength is inevitably going to go down. And I don't see the jobs concern, frankly, being as much of a factor for DOD military personnel as it is for as it is in contracting.
Well, I think you've given us a lot to think about. The article is fantastic. So kudos to you for kind of laying stake to some things to watch. The politics of these discussions are always different in some ways from the strategic analysis that our community engages in. So we'll definitely keep an eye on both. Thank you so much for joining us, Nora. It's a real treat.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's go ahead and move on to keeping up foreign relations and maybe just kind of segue from our conversation with Nora to think a little bit about how this current situation with the global pandemic might affect what we lovingly call the global world order, the liberal international order, whatever it is. There's some ways that states interact in the international system, and there's some institutions related to that, and those things may change. So there's been lots of speculation. Does anybody have a favorite take, a favorite question, the thing that you think is most interesting as we try to think about internationally what these things are going to look like in the next few years?
Well, so to set like two very broad thematic questions up, I guess it was 3 weeks ago-ish, Dan Dresner did a couple of pieces in the Washington Post, and he's done others since then. Then with the first one teeing up like, well, actually, as it turns out that the internationals like didn't work very well. But the second being like, but actually, maybe the solution to the coronavirus crisis is going to demonstrate that collaborative and cooperative solutions are the only way that we get out of this, and therefore we will see a resurgence of this. It's a great question. We're going to talk about a couple of examples of this going forward in terms of like how Hungary is responding to this, how Israel is responding, how many other individual countries are responding. But almost all countries are grappling with the question of how to reopen in some way at some point in time. What almost none of them are grappling with is their reopening strategy is fundamentally reliant on other countries too, even if they're not talking about it, whether it be their imports or travel restrictions or other things like that. But we're handling the reopening question as though it's a fundamentally domestic one, and it is absolutely an international one at heart. So to me, like I feel like we're all kind of like navel gazing at a moment where actually in not wanting to acknowledge the number of international collaboration and coordination issues that are going to be part of this, because in some ways it just seems too hard and overwhelming, and also because we feel let down in some ways. There's an emotion tied to this as well as a logic.
So, and I think actually that resonates with kind of how I've been thinking about this, which is, you know, I actually used to say this a lot in our first season with Trump. There's always like this kind of kernel of truth and stuff he said, right? And when he, for instance, attacks the WHO, now is not maybe the time to cut their funding, but some of the criticisms are correct. They are probably
totally
too soft, right? And so I think what a lot of the pandemic crisis has revealed is a lot of weakness in our international institutions that were kind of forged in just a really different crisis era. And I guess what I wonder slash and like starting to think about is now the time in some ways to reset both on the economic side and on the international institution side? Like, what do these need to look like? How dependent should they be on large powers that can have outsized influence like China or frankly the US, right? How much do we want them to be more sort of mandatorily resourced or more independent? How much do we want them to rely on voluntary contributions and voluntary orders? How much do we want them to integrate security and economic things, right? Like, so these ideas we had that we sort of divvied up in the 40s and 50s, and then we've kind of chugged along. And I feel like now is a potential inflection point. So that could be something, or it could be a total disaster. Just to be
clear. Well, and I think that that kind of begs the question about who's going to write the rules for those institutions. And then you kind of get into this fundamental question of how this moment affects, you know, the U.S.-China competition, whatever that strategic rivalry will look like. Does it push us toward more nationalist, you know, policies, which we've already seen quite a bit of in the last couple of years? Or to Lauren's point, does it sort of drive us into the, you know, the only way out is through kind of logic, and we have to actually cooperate at some kind of international level? And I think the commentators are, at least from what I've seen, you know, we don't know. So there's kind of, there's evidence for both, and there's plausibility for both. But I think that there's, if you take this conversation we just had with Nora about how this could dramatically change the defense budget, I mean, China has been the kind of, you know, sequinon of the defense budget for at least the last, you know, several cycles. And so thinking about if that relationship changes, or, you know, our ability to fund the competition changes, you know, what does that sort of look like? I'm not sure. More broadly, you know, Tom Wright had a piece earlier in the month about some of these challenges, and kind of raises the question, you know, is this the death knell for globalization, you know, which has been on sort of rocky footing really since the last financial crisis. And you've seen, certainly that's, I think, when you start seeing the turn toward populism in some key places, you start seeing breakdown amongst EU states, both economically and somewhat politically. You know, is this the piece that's where everybody's going to say, nope, can't have those globalized supply chains. Nope. Can't have such free movement of people. Nope. Can't rely on international institutions. You know, in the immortal words of my youngest niece, I could do it myself. So, you know, I think that that's probably a little over the horizon and potentially too far, but I can also see how we get there from here. And, you know, it's a function of all of these things, both institutional weakness, populism at home, and, you know, some of these other challenges. But I do think that getting back to internationalized response requires really a significant amount of leadership, and by which I mean compromise. And I don't know where that comes from right now. So that's kind of where I end up on the world order pieces. So other thoughts here before we move on to some specific examples?
I guess the last thing I would say, so in Nora's discussion, we were talking a lot about the dominance of the defense budget in our national politics, as well as we were just talking about how that China has dominated the defense discussion. China has obviously put a lot of emphasis in its own national security and defense budget, but the other place it just puts a lot of emphasis is in filling up its bureaucratic roles and like building up Chinese presence in international institutions in a way that the United States has fundamentally withdrawn from in the last 30 years. It actually never really wanted to be a part of to begin with, but has not dominated for a couple of decades. And there's a reason why we're seeing the World Health Organization be very cozy with China. There's a reason that we see UN institutions being very cozy with China. We have withdrawn from those roles and are not setting international standards, participating in regulatory bodies, and setting a U.S. agenda via those, because we feel as though we can do that from our perch institutionally. So if we want to reset our defense budget, we also need to be rethinking about resetting our roles in all of those institutions as well, if we care about continuing them in some way. We could also just cede this if we wanted to, or say that they're irrelevant if we wanted to.
And I want to put a pin in that and come back to it when we talk a little about sanctions, because I think that is basically the question on dollar-denominated trade. Like, that's where we are right now.
All right, Lauren, you have some observations about some things going on in Israel and Hungary, neither of which I have any idea about. So please enlighten us and help us understand some things that are going on beyond the, you know, 3 inches past my, you know, outside the door of my apartment.
Hungary has not been exactly the most emblematic world democracy on the planet for the last several years, but it did something a couple of weeks ago that, as Zach Beecham said in his Vox piece, basically made the subtext text, where Orban put through a law that suspends elections and basically gives him total authority, as President Trump might say, indefinitely until this coronavirus crisis is done.
I believe he's ruling by decree now,
which is effectively where he was. His party dominated every aspect of Hungary's politics, but that just makes it a lot easier for him to do things that he otherwise would have done with a veneer of democracy on top of it. He's using that opportunity, though, to do a lot of things might have slid by before. The term that he uses or others uses about his country is peacock actions, where he does absolutely absurd, over the top, dictatorial, authoritarian actions, and then sort of slowly backs off of them after he gets some criticism. One of those examples being is buying up any independent journalism outlets that might have otherwise criticized him, and cutting off funding from federal funding to opposition parties that were never going to have a seat at the table really to begin with, but are definitely going to be significantly weakened as a result of that. So it's certainly not where we see the United States at, and it's not where we see a lot of our allies at, but you do see the trends that he is taking advantage of in this crisis moment to say, all these things are weakening. People are terrified of the coronavirus. I can accumulate all this power in order to address it. Here's the ways that I can weaken institutions that might check me from doing things that are unacceptable. So that's one giant concern that I think we should be paying attention to.
And actually, like on that, I think the other piece that he's doing is how can I make the existing structures more dependent on me? So a lot of their like structure and payments in terms of economic relief are like government tied funds, not direct cash to businesses, right? They're not just giving you money back. They're giving subsidies or agreeing to pay like part of your wage bill costs or giving tax breaks, right? And these are all sort of like ties to the government that are dependent essentially on him remaining in power for those economic conditions to retain, as opposed to, say, me just giving you a direct cash transfer to try to infuse cash into the economy, which very much sort of allows the economy to reallocate and trade in theory, assuming we return to a period where we're trading, even internally. And so I think it's interesting to see even the carrots in this respect look quite different, actually, than the structure of a lot of the sort of subsidies and support in other European countries.
And I suppose we're waiting for the EU response, or there's potential. I mean, is this the sort of thing you get kicked out of the EU for?
I think they're cross.
That's effectively where they are right now, is that they are cross. And another place, and God, I cannot believe I'm talking about Israel's elections again. It is Sunday. Things could change in the next day or so. As of last Thursday, the president of Israel had said, like, okay, apparently neither of you, either Netanyahu or Gantz, can actually form a government. So I'm asking parliament to try to form a government. And you have a deadline. And after that, if you haven't met that deadline, we're going to have elections again.
Which would be the fourth Israeli elections in 18 months or something ridiculous.
Right. So what's interesting about this is that, I mean, things could change easily as they have in Israel over a period of time, but like that Netanyahu's response to coronavirus has at least at the outset been pretty popular. If we had elections again, it could be to his favor. Could be, because they're actually right now people are pushing back against them because they feel as though he went way too far initially in shutting down the country without putting in other measures that might have also helped, like protective gear or otherwise. But again, the holdup is the exact same thing we've talked about over and over again, as whether or not, if the high court rules that Netanyahu is guilty of corruption charges, whether or not he can be prime minister. And this continues to be negotiated back and forth between blue and white party, which totally fell apart, more or less, or blue or white coalition, and the Likud, which continues to put up Netanyahu as their poster child. We will see in a couple of days whether or not they have managed, parliament has managed to form a government where nobody else has managed to. But in all likelihood, we are looking at another election where Netanyahu, because of this crisis moment, could end up coming out on top without having this problem of coalition building.
Raises a very interesting question about how you actually manage an election during a pandemic, something that we're going to have to confront and at the national level.
Right. But that's what South Korea just did. So just briefly, South Korea had their parliamentary elections, and you know, TBD, whether or not there is a resurgence in infections in 2 weeks, we'll see. But the initial judgment was they handled them pretty well in terms of people going to the polling places, all had to have their temperatures taken, all had to use protective gear, social distancing was put in force. If you had a fever, you had to go into a separate place in order to cast your vote. It not surprisingly gave a pretty resounding victory to President Moon's party, who already had a majority, but now has like one of the most substantial majorities that any party has had in Korea for a long time. So good in some ways for crisis stability, but an interesting dynamic to watch in terms of those who are having elections over the next year, whether or not that crisis bump will help those in power or their response will ultimately hurt them. But Korea's has been pretty substantially good overall.
Wow, thank God for Lauren, because I had no idea about any of that. So kudos. Thank you. Bravo. Radha, we haven't done a deep dive on trade in quite some time. So would you like to tell us some things about trade or raise some questions for us to explore?
Let me break this into two parts, which is one, let me just remind us, sort of keeping on Lauren's theme of things happening in other parts of the world, about Iran, which is like extremely hard hit by coronavirus and coronavirus infections and is suffering particularly because it lacks resources like PPE and ventilators, as well as medical supplies. And it's very hard to trade with them because of the sanctions that we reimposed post the withdrawal from the Iran deal. So this is sort of like the confluence of global pandemic crisis, trade, and national security priorities that is actually like pretty disastrous for Iran. It's a complicated situation and it's going to illuminate a couple of problems, which I just want to highlight, which is one, technically, you can actually do humanitarian supplies to Iran. But practically, because of the structure of sanctions, that's really hard to do. And the reason is because first, you need institutions that are connected to dollar-denominated banks, and there aren't really any in Iran. Second, you need to get approval on compliance that you're sort of only doing this stuff to avoid secondary sanctions, and who's going to be reviewing and vetting your company to confirm that you've complied with the regulations that are only selling, or the sanctions and only selling relevant things. And three, you need export licenses. So the solution is too strong. Like alternative approach here has been the WHO helping provide supplies to Iran, as well as a number of very hard hit, sort of undersupplied countries globally to try to sort of contain the pandemic. But of course, the US is cutting funding there. And that funding is sort of a key area for Iran. So I think, like, in a nutshell, this really illustrates the dependence on sort of international institutions to solve problems, and also the dependence on this dollar denominated US driven trade system, both of which are sort of consequences of our current slash under criticism world order economic issues. And the third thing it illustrates, of course, is what we talked about earlier, which is the supply chain dependency, right? Countries have specialized at this point and are dependent on trade with other countries to get key components. And so sort of returning to some of what we started talking about with Nora, I think this really highlights both the potential direction international institutions are going to need to move in order to actually be useful. And second, like either the benefit or risks of this sort of isolationist autarkic situation, right? Which is you need to be able to solve things yourself, but then you really need to be able to solve things yourself. Because if you can't, you're just screwed, right? And that means like you can't, and there can't be any, right? If countries around the world aren't solving the pandemic and the US has, and the US hasn't solved the pandemic, unless it means we don't take any stuff from other countries and we don't take any people from other countries. Same thing for everywhere else, right? So it's like you end up on a very far end of the spectrum.
Erin, I am thinking back to our conversation 2 weeks ago, and if there's an interesting parallel piece to be written about individuals who are not quarantining, who are social distancing at home by themselves, who live by themselves, and the sort of collaborative that you set up amongst your other single lady friends to take care of one another, as opposed to those of us who are quarantining with their families or who are very far away from their families. Anyway, there's an interesting sort of like parallel piece to be written on the international system and how people are doing social distancing at home.
I'm going to let you write that piece.
Okay.
There's definitely a question about, you know, self-help cooperatives versus, you know, sort of top-down kinds of pieces. You know, I was just kind of also thinking about on the supply chain issue, and we were talking a moment ago about, you know, the logic versus the emotion of the situation. And if our supply chains, you know, for PPE in particular, or some of the test reagents, which are also in short supply, if those were coming from Japan or Germany or Canada instead of China, if we would feel differently about that supply chain issue, if the policy response would be different, if there would be, you know, if the US would be open to more cooperation, if the partner government would be more open to cooperation instead of it being caught up in this, you know, strategic competition mix more broadly with you know, China's role in the international system. I don't have any idea what the answer is to that question, but it feels like it might be a little bit different, not just, you know, for a whole variety of reasons. So anyway, have we more on trade? Are we good?
I think
fantastic. I don't even know where to begin with White House mayhem. Do you guys watch the briefings? I definitely don't. I can't even be on Twitter during the briefings anymore. It's such a cluster.
So I don't read Tom Nichols' Twitter a lot for a number of reasons, but I do always just kind of use him as like a calibration for whenever the briefings came on. And like right. He says, he's like, oh, he appears to have taken speed while in the waiting room. Like, okay, so that's, I'm just going to put the phone down now. We're good. Right.
We do have, I mean, there's a couple of notable pieces. I mean, I think we could all, you know, in our own public policy hats, do some deep dives on the standards by which we're, you know, saying economies are going to quote unquote reopen, and the overall, I mean, I just have incredible frustration over our testing strategy or lack thereof. And I have really no clear sense how things get back to quote unquote normal unless there's massive testing, but we're going to bracket all of that for the moment. And, Lauren, you had kind of noted one of the second order effects from this, and again, part of a long running chain, has been the impact on journalism.
Yeah.
We've noticed this with specialty journalism, like the trade magazines that cover the defense industry, for example, but also with local journalists. And so, you know, there is kind of a tie amongst this with, you know, institutional weakness and challenges and covering things and the role of the media in a moment like this.
Yeah, I mean, since the beginning, not exclusively since the beginning of the Trump administration, but certainly a factor since then, has been his administration's efforts to weaken or discredit institutions that were meant to be independent analysts of some kind, to provide a judgment on the actions of government, whether it be the judiciary, the media, or the intelligence community, or to offer their own outside analysis. And the media has clearly been his target for a long time, with really no let up in a lot of ways. And these press briefings are quite often the biggest place for that, but not exclusively. But what's happening at the same time is, I mean, people are not, I'm sure, aware of like the slow death of local journalism as a lot of these papers and others are being bought up by larger institutions, quite often ones who are trying to suck all the profit out of them as much as possible, and then selling them off once again to the high bidder. But right now, we're also seeing a challenge of advertising, where either companies don't have enough funding to want to advertise with, or one interesting factor is they're not wanting to put their ads next to any coronavirus coverage because of the negative association. Well, that's where everything is right now, is coronavirus coverage.
And nobody can go out to buy anything. So it's kind of a futile exercise unless you have a new iPhone to sell. There's just not a lot of demand.
So the announcements over the last several weeks have been about very popular and seemingly successful institutions either furloughing, laying off, or decreasing salaries to a lot of their reporters at a point in time where we need that sort of oversight and coverage arguably the most, and both at local papers, but also at big, not national ones, but like The Trade and other popular ones like Vox, Military Times, Defense News, and a lot of ones that we are relying on right to help tell stories that we would not otherwise see.
And not to make everything like about economics, but it's a really interesting sort of confluence of this sort of really critical, like deeply critical social value of being able to tell us the news we need on, especially sort of detailed stories that you won't really get elsewhere. And the economic model that sort of journalism has moved towards and the sort of underlying structure of it that does leave it really vulnerable to this generally, but sort of the combination of large purchases, ownership structures, advertising dependence. And I just don't wonder if part of the longer run impact of this pandemic is trying sort of forcing us to rethink a number of these models. I'm trying to put my optimist hat on and say, maybe we'll figure out a model that allows a lot of this independent journalism to continue in some form. And I just don't know what that model is, but I'm hoping people are coming up with it.
So one of the stories that these trade publications have covered, of course, is Captain Crozier and the Teddy Roosevelt, the aircraft carrier that has now, we think, you know, over 700 positive cases of COVID-ID. They're ashore, essentially, in Guam. I don't know that we have a lot to add to this discussion. I think it's going to be a case that's taught for years and years and years on both civil-military relations and the way in which the captain himself handled the response, the way the Assistant Secretary, you know, the Undersecretary of the Navy, the Acting Secretary of the Navy handled the response and then, you know, himself resigned, you know, 24 hours later. There is, I think, parallel to the conversation we had with Nora, a little bit to be said about, you know, do we care most about the, quote, warfighting readiness of these crews, or do we actually care about the health and well-being of the soldiers and sailors, airmen and Marines, you know, of the armed forces? On a slightly lighter note, though, there's been a lot of discussion, more so than maybe we ever thought possible, about haircuts and
hair standards.
And I am, as somebody who's desperate for a haircut, like my hair is so overgrown and like, I'm like a character out of Mario Kart with a mushroom head right now. You know, do we, where, you know, is, are haircuts critical to the, you know, discipline of our armed forces? Are they all being ridiculous? Why can't these men figure out what their policy is about haircuts?
This is a really good question. And I have to say that, you know, when I worked on personnel and readiness issues in an administration, I was told repeatedly and consistently how critical our hair standards were for maintaining order and discipline in the force. Critical, guys. We couldn't possibly relax them in any way, even for otherwise qualified people with religious exemptions like Sikhs, to continue to serve in the military when they wanted to, because it was so important, so very important. And then you get one little pandemic and the men don't want to take a razor to their head just to stay in. So I'm saying, you know, turns out you can still have order and discipline with hair.
Also, there are these people called women in the force who do not, in fact, are not allowed to shave their heads. So there's a whole other set of standards there.
There have actually been some really great substantive commentary on this issue. And like, it's, in some ways, it's ridiculous how much attention we're paying to this. But the military is paying this attention to us. They're giving us no choice. But Brett Friedman had a great thread about how haircuts were used as one means to effectively take away identity amongst recruits in a draft army, or where you were recruiting large numbers of people from across the country with very, very different backgrounds, to take away identity and print them with a new identity that would help you generate this order and discipline. We have a very, very different force right now than we did in the 40s and 50s and 60s for that matter. Order and discipline, still important, but that necessity of creating 100% new identity via the means of haircuts is maybe something that could be a change to other factors. Jackie Schneider, similarly, has had pieces related to what Radha is talking about and how haircuts have been used as various ways to deny people the ability to serve in some form. So I recommend looking at her work as well. I also made a commentary that got lots of weird attention about, like, gosh, apparently if we're able to do things like haircuts in the middle of a pandemic, maybe we could do things like, I don't know, punish and prevent sexual assaults in the military, which was an absurd comment on purpose and deliberately. But it does show you the amount of attention that the military pays to things that it does decide are important to itself and can actually enforce things that seem to be against what its culture stands for if it chooses to. But there we are. Haircuts, guys. Do them or don't.
It also provided us an opportunity to remind folks that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is not in anybody's chain of command.
No. Nope.
And you know, it is fascinating to watch the discussion between him and the Secretary of Defense on live television. So, you know, there's many things that they could be planning for. I'm glad that haircuts are getting their attention. Perhaps they could now turn toward proper care and feeding of the rest of our folks in uniform. So, why don't we maintain slightly that same lighthearted sentiment and move into kind of an adjusted pop culture? You know, we've really used pop culture to talk about self-soothing here for a while, but maybe adjust this to a little bit of a check-in, which is how we're feeling, you know, how we're doing and what we're, you know, what's making us happy, to take a note from Pop Culture Happy Hour. So before we get to the happy, though, can we offer our condolences to the broader Iyengar family, who's had a very rough week? Radha, we hope you guys are hanging in there okay.
Thank you. So we unfortunately lost my grandmother earlier this week to complications with actually COVID. She, you know, she was elderly and she had led a good life. And I was saying to Aaron and Lauren earlier, part of the sort of what makes this crisis hard is less, you know, losing an elderly family member is always sad, but there's a sort of ritual and community about it that you can maintain of getting together and sitting by their bedside and then having a funeral and kind of really honoring their life. And that all is on pause now. In New York State, actually, there's massive delays in funerals. There are a couple of really good articles in New York Times Metro section, the New York section of the paper, actually has been covering this in some detail. And so it means, you know, people wait weeks for their loved ones to get buried. They can't actually have funerals. So, you know, it's a difficult time to lose someone generally, but it's especially difficult when you're far from home and far from family. And so my grandmother, just two quick sort of bombshell themed stories on her. One is when I was getting ready to marry my husband, my grandmother, who lived for many years in the UK, told us, you know, well, they have all these UK whiskeys and, you know, people really like scotch, but there's this Indian whiskey. And it's amazing. We're like, uh-huh, the Indians, like, not so famous for their whiskeys, but okay, tell me more. And she's like, well, it's this whiskey called Antiquity. We'll get it for you guys. It is not a whiskey. It is a blended malt liquor beverage. And it is truly amazing, not in a good way. So my husband and I were just trying to figure out where we might acquire and have delivered Antiquity to drink in order to celebrate her life at her Zoom funeral in a couple of weeks. So we are working on that. And the second story in terms of self-care and on a slightly lighter note is that, you know, as part of, you know, day-to-day life, we do a lot of video calls now. And that mostly means that what I can do is look at my roots getting longer and longer and longer and unable to go to a hairdresser. And so I kind of sent a message to my salon here in San Francisco, Archer Salon, who are just the loveliest people. And they sent a kit with my own formula for roots, a whole kit of how to like do my roots, handwritten instructions, and a YouTube video. So my Sunday night is definitely going to be doing my roots, and it's going to be just so great with champagne. Roots with champagne.
What could go wrong? Lauren, how are you doing?
Mostly okay. Like, there's just a lot of family togetherness with my husband, my 5-year-old, and my dog and my cat. I have my son and I have become, we do a lot of dancing. We'll have dance part. We have to do. He and I choose like one form of exercise we do together a day. So we have a lot of dance parties. So my most recent obsession, which has been challenged by the fact that I don't have a TikTok account, is TikTok dances, of which there's a lot, but you can find them on YouTube videos and try to teach yourself these TikTok dances. I am maybe a little more obsessed with it than my 5-year-old. In like, I was in dance for 15 years as a kid, and well, not quite that long, 10 years as a kid. And like anytime I see a new routine, I'm like, oh, I totally want to learn that. And Wyatt is like, I'm done after 1 minute. Like, no. We've got to do this until we totally master this dance. I also suggested to my workplace that we do a blinding light TikTok dance challenge that I will share at some point in time on Twitter. Actually, I have shared it on Twitter. And several of them were like, what's this? And the other two of them said, yes, this is awesome. And the rest of them were like, Lauren, you need to get a hobby. So my hobby has, other than TikTok dances, been reading more young adult fiction, which I picked up a new novel recently by Sherry Thomas, who wrote the Charlotte Holmes books that Radha and I both really love.
I know, I'm so excited. I'm so excited.
And it's a young adult series, the Elementals trilogy, and the first one called Burning Skies, and it has romance and boarding schools and magic, and it's just great. It's been wonderful so far. Balm to the soul. Erin, what about you?
I'm okay. I intermittently have sort of minor meltdowns over when I'm going to see my family again, which in some ways is kind of odd because I don't see my family that often. But as you guys may know, I'm kind of a control freak. And so not knowing when I would be able to choose to see them again has left me a bit bereft. So I think I mentioned last week, I have a new bike. And so I've been kind of exploring on the bike, and that's been interesting and fun. But I've also been finally indulging in my balcony project. And so Lauren is quite sick of all of my questions about flowers because I know nothing about how to grow things. But it's also given me occasion to like email with my cousins, or text with them, you know, who are in fact fabulous gardeners, both for flowers and for edibles. And so I basically have a balcony designed to fuel good cocktails. And so I have lots of herbs, but I also have blackberries and blueberries. We'll see if they grow. I have a little bit of cherry tomato, which I would not put in a cocktail, obviously, but I don't like tomatoes, but I really like mozzarella cheese. And so this is sort of like a cheese delivery device as far as I'm concerned.
That's right.
And then eventually we'll do some flower boxes out there. So just, I kind of feel like I'm going to be here a while. And so it should look nice and maybe vaguely, I don't not really be able to feed me. I mean, I'm not going to live off cherry tomatoes and basil, although there are worse things, but just a sort of, I'm going to be here. I'm not going to be traveling. I can water everything when it needs to be watered. I can do all the weird things and stuff. And also the guy at Merrifield Garden Center was really quite attractive. So,
well, look, when you're ready to kill all of those plants, I'm your girl.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. We'll provide periodic updates. You know, we can ask how I'm doing and how my plants are doing. This is could be a fairly spectacularly expensive fail project on my part. So we'll hopefully not, though. We'll try to make it work.
Yeah. A few days ago, Ross and Wyatt planted potatoes in a big barrel in our backyard. And I'm kind of like, first of all, like really potatoes, like we can just buy those. Those are really easy to buy
right. And
also quite cheap.
Right.
But like, you know, okay, if the end of the world's going to come, we got a big giant store of potatoes in our backyard. Sure, why not?
Sure, why not? Why not? All right, ladies, this has been fantastic. It's good to hear what's going on with you and what's going on in the world. Radha, lots of love to you and your mom and all the Iyengars. And we'll see everybody again in a couple of weeks.